Hello and welcome. This is the Watson Weekend. I'm Rick Watson.
Hi, I'm Jessica Laseski. Already stress wrapping Q4 predictions with shaky optimism and a broken tape dispenser. I'm not a good rapper, Rick.
No, not at all. We are diving headfirst into peak from the Black Friday circus to January's hangover.
It is retail therapy for those of us too jaded to call it a holiday miracle.
It is a holiday miracle, though, on 34th Street.
I always believe, Rick, because my mom taught me, if you believe, you receive. So, yeah.
Do you think that the Macy's Santa still sends people to other stores?
That was Kohl's, because Macy's, remember, didn't want to buy the naming rights in the movies. That's on the second. Well, I'm talking the remake in the 90s. I can't remember what the was it. Yeah. Gimbals? What was the no? That yeah. was Gimbals. Anyway, no,
that was a guy who committed suicide or something. Or
that was the Christmas story. So, but yeah, here we go. We do have a great show for you today,
and we're already off script.
Already, you can't keep us contained here. You just can't. But we do want to acknowledge our amazing sponsor. Rick, tell us who brings the program to the people today.
Yeah, bringing it to the people is our great sponsor, Rithm. Commerce faces rising costs, unpredictable customers, and the rapid rise of AI. A new Rithm survey actually shows the bigger risk isn't tariffs or inflation, it's internal drag. Slow processes and messy data are holding brands and retailers back. This is the truth. Tackling it. And why speed and agility will be the real edge in the next year, 2026. Download it at rithm.com/ready, RITHUM.com/ready.
Yeah. Speaking my language. Again. That's right. Data messy is the data. Data is the heart of business, people.
It's the new oil, but the shit gets all over you.
Yes, it does. All right. Well, as usual, we're going to bring you Headline Hangover. Let's hit it. Okay, Rick. So it has been kind of a bruising situation. And what we've decided is we're going to give you your due. We're going to do a little layup. So this is your layup zone. And we just are trying to give you some easy wins here.
Okay.
On behalf of myself and the producers of our show.
Understood. Thank
you. So what you got here? This is your guess.
We have a story. Blank will accelerate the end of brick and mortar's reign, Amazon CEO. Okay, come on, guys. It's AI.
Yes! Yay!
I'm in fighting shape.
Yes, your boy Andy Jassy did say that AI is going to be the death of brick and mortar dominance. This really is the game changer. Alexa is going to write the eulogy. Jassy says AI is going to make online shopping faster, cheaper, more personalized, because nothing says personal like Rufus selling you some more toilet paper. So,
love it.
Yep. While retailers are hanging up the now hiring signs, Amazon's hanging up the now automating. All right. So this is the second one in your layup category.
Password to the Lou's video surveillance system was blank, according to employee.
This is a good one.
This is a good one. I like it. I think the answer has to be password, doesn't it?
Oh, so close.
Or secret?
Lou.
Lou. Oh, I can't even.
It was really close. It could have been password. It was Lou. And nothing says security like
the name of the place.
The name of the place, you know? Look, lots of people need access to this. You got one. So
I got one. I'm in the layups. Even LeBron misses a layup sometimes.
Yeah. Oh, does he though? I don't know.
Ouch. I think this one is yours. ThredUp launches a blank offering, enabling direct selling on its platform for the first time.
Peer-to-peer. I did see the story.
We have a winner. ThredUp is an interesting company. They have always been kind of a managed marketplace where they have the inventory in-house. It's already vetted. third-party sellers aren't really there. The new peer-to-peer model basically makes ThredUp, at least as optionally, like other places. And a couple of quotes here, the CEO referred to it as a new vector of growth, which is kind of obvious. It also makes their supply chain more resilient, meaning like, it's your shit. It's your shit, not ours.
Right. Yeah. Don't send it to us in a bag.
Exactly. And so I guess the only question is authenticity. Where is it? Is Max Lightman helping them out? If not, they should call up Linda Stuff.
They should give them a call for sure. I didn't see a lot of authenticity references here. I'm sure there's got to be some restrictions, right, on what you can and can't list. But it really is just taking that acceleration probably too of getting the inventory on the site faster, which may allow them to take advantage of trends that like other marketplaces can take advantage of that they can't. Like when there's drops that sell out very quickly, ThredUp can't do that, right? If you don't have the capabilities to list super quickly and you got to get all the inventory to them. So it'll be interesting to see how this changes their dynamics.
Yeah. I mean, they, one of the things that they mentioned was that the majority items on peer-to-peer marketplaces actually don't sell. And so that's kind of their opportunity. It's like, people don't want the stuff at all. And so how is ThredUp going to make them sell was not revealed. Mm-hmm. that's what we're going to look forward to.
Yeah.
Next up, we have to go back to AI.
Of course.
And I know what you're thinking on this one. It's not what you're thinking. I know how your mind works. Agentic commerce is a huge opportunity for retailers. It's also a blank storm.
Perfect.
It is
liability
storm.
Okay.
That's a challenge. Look, the author of the article is talking about agentic commerce with regards to essentially eyes closed buying, meaning like you tell your agent to do something and they go off and do it and they don't check back in with you. What happens if the data is wrong? It doesn't buy the right thing. Etc. So the reality is that's going to be a percentage of agentic commerce. It's not going to be all of agentic commerce because the human is still probably going to double check things. I mean, if I'm not going to tell an agent to buy, at least in a normal scenario, to buy something for $2,000, without at least saying like, hey, can I review this? I might want to buy it at a store because maybe I couldn't get it in time. We also, I mean, in the worst case scenario, you have sort of the self-driving car problem where you don't know if a robot hits a pedestrian, what happens? Like, this is low stakes in comparison. So I'm not worried about, like, I'm not crying for the lawyers here. I'm sure they're going to get a lot of work out of this. So I don't know. What's your take, Jess?
Yeah, I mean, look, in the world of the agentic commerce protocol, there will be protocols that are developed, as you said. I don't think that this is the thing to lose sleep over at night. There's lots of other issues in the world of AI. And really, this is just the next generation of kids being able to buy stuff through an Alexa, right? Remember when parents would come home and they'd have all these Amazon boxes and they're like, how did this get here? And it's like, well, the kids were just asking Alexa to buy all this stuff. I think that's like this next iteration. So just kind of lock down your credit cards, guys, and keep a watchful eye, you know, don't let those bots go crazy.
Correct.
Okay. Well, we'll see if you get a chance to redeem yourself.
Yes.
All right. Why Coca-Cola keeps pushing the limits of blank despite backlash?
Why Coca-Cola keeps pushing the limits of its formula?
Generative AI. Oh. This is an AI story, Rick, as many are. Here's the thing. I don't know if you've seen this ad or remember this ad, but picture this. It's a snowy night. Christmas lights are twinkling. the Coke bottle clinking opens in the orchestra of just a generative AI world is unfolding. Right. Coke has their holiday ad. It's back. It has everything you need. We have baby sloth. We have squirrels. We have cute little penguins. We have some weavers woven in there. You, of course, have your Santa winking. But, you know, the people are not happy with this. Like, it just doesn't feel as authentic and real. This isn't like the nostalgic Coke ads that we grew up with, but they are doubling down and saying, guys, this is our best performing ad. We are doing it. So I don't know if you've remembered this one, but the dream lives on, I guess. And we'll see what happens. Like, do we care what the people want if they're just still drinking Coke?
Yeah, clearly I'm also out of the layup zone here and not up on my pop culture.
As much
as I need to be.
It's okay because, you know, just like when Mariah Carey says it's time, you also know it's time when you see Santa Coke, okay? Like,
exactly.
That's when you know the season is ready.
PSL and then Santa Coke.
PSL and then Santa Coke. And then I don't know, I guess we go back to like Athletic Greens because people are, you know, going to cleanse their bodies in January. All right. So now we go on to your other favorite love language, retail media. The $176 billion retail media opportunity has a generation what?
Generation problem?
Yes. Good job.
Something.
There you go.
Finally, I get something.
You got it. Yes, you got it. So yes, there is the $176 billion retail media boom, but we have a massive generational facepalm hiding inside it. Crocker, Rick, do you believe that Gen Z shops the same as boomers?
No.
Yeah, I know that. So that's basically the big revelation that was coming out of this story. Vibenomics surveyed 973 shoppers, found Gen Z and millennials are five times more likely to buy after hearing something, after hearing an in-store audio ad than boomers. Five times. So Gen Z finds this in-store audio enjoyable. Only 25% of boomers agree. And really the revelation here is that Gen Z has grown up hearing ads as they're streaming. It's just kind of second nature. Boomers are like, I'm in stores. Like, this doesn't make sense. You know, that's for the television. And I usually try to see through those. So again, like the big revelation here is if you're in retail media, you got to tailor to your audience and give them what they want.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe they're just old people shopping in your stores and it's bad, but get the youngsters in there. It's all right.
Well, my favorite ahas in the story was, oh, if you're in the electronics section, you should do like more cool digital ads. If you're in the pharmacy, probably not. So it's like, really? Are we?
Isn't it the same consumer?
I don't know. I don't go in the pharmacy anymore. I just take, I'm like pumping my body full of vitamins. So
are you one of those Amazon pharmacy people?
Yeah, I've become one, you know, if it doesn't show up in an Amazon box, I probably don't have it. So I'm just, again, Alexa's shopping, Rufus is shopping. I don't need to shop for myself.
Nice. I like it.
All right. Well, that's closed out the headline hangover. Congrats on scoring the W. This is a milestone moment.
This is a historic day.
Yeah. It's not going to happen again because we're not in the world of giving freebies, but you know, we felt it's like Thanksgiving and just felt like we should do something nice. So
this
we're getting
close. What happened to Friendsgiving? You know,
Friendsgiving.
That's something we should do.
Yeah. We can call that. Okay. So we got to get into the show. You had an amazing guest. I was not able to join this interview, but it was so strong. And let's kind of talk through who you interviewed and share with the world what we're going to dive into later.
Yeah, we're back into agentic, but I think the big story is 18-year-old Liam Fuller is a Dubliner. And he's already started three companies by the time he's 18. So just like my tagline here, 18 in life to go. There's a lot more this young man can do and will do. He flew to New York. He raised money. He's visiting customers. He's living out of his parents. You know, he's not living with his parents for the first time. And it's super interesting to hear his take on the world, building a company, how to meet customers. all the things that first time founders go through, but imagine doing it without, you know, significant life experience at the same time in a new country. So that's what I think makes the story so interesting and relatable, imagining yourself in that situation. So excited for everyone to hear it today.
Great. Yeah, let's roll it.
All right, Liam, it's great to be able to talk to you. I would love to kick things off kind of very simply. How did you get started in all this?
Well, yeah, thanks for having me on. Yeah, I think I got started into all of this doing national science competitions when I was around 13 or 14. So competing internationally at science fairs. I think I started when I believe GPT-2 or 2 came out. I think I was still kind of playing around with those models. And I kind of started doing some competitions. 1 year I built a robotic arm, which kind of failed pretty miserably. And the year after, I really got into LLMs and I started playing around with voice assistants and other things like that. So that's kind of how it started. And over the years, it kind of evolved to, I went to America, I got exposed to what other people my age were doing over there. And it turned out a lot of what people were doing were startups, even at a very young age. I got very intrigued by that. And as I kind of continued doing those competitions, I realized I wanted to start my own thing. And that so happened to start being in e-commerce and retail, because I was quite interested in that. So that's kind of how I got started, Rick.
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting. It's not often that someone who's 18 years old is already on their third company. Mm-hmm. You're from Ireland. So talk to me about, like, how did you get to the United States? What did you learn when you first got here?
Yeah, I think what I learned here is that it's way different to Ireland, let alone Europe, right? It's a whole different dynamic, whole different situation. I think coming from Ireland, there tends to be, like, one thing I did notice in particular was that if you're trying to sell to a retailer or a brand or any business in Ireland or Europe, it was this weird dynamic of, like, there was a really big it was almost like you had to kind of start a relationship with them over a very long period of time. And then you would mature into, like, okay, now we're business friends and now we're going to work on something together. And that's kind of how it evolves here. But in America, it's like you really have to change the way you sell into being very, very confident about what you're doing, which tends to be a little bit hard for, I think, Irish guys who are generally pretty humble about what they're doing and what they want to bring into the world. So I think that was the main difference I kind of found. And, you know, I think getting over to the US was very, very important to me. I split my time between Paris and the US at the moment. Uh-huh. And I think the dynamic is way different. And I feel like if you came in and were just like, oh, I'm just starting this little thing, people aren't going to take you as seriously as maybe going on the verge of potentially being cocky and saying, oh, I'm working on the best thing in the world for retailers and brands. You guys are going to love it. You need this. That kind of thing. So I think that was one of the main differences I found from the US and Ireland. But
That's fascinating. Look, sometimes it doesn't work out. I think the Irish way is a really good way for a lot of life. Sometimes the startups in the US that are very cocky and brash don't always really work out. I'm thinking of, like, Theranos, you know, it's going to change the world with a drop of blood. Like, no, it's not really possible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I agree with you there. There's definitely a barrier there. I would say that. So,
talk to me about your current setup. Like, what is it that you're trying to build now?
Sure.
And who, what types of customers are you trying to target?
Sure. So, I think give a bit more context. As soon as I finished those, you know, competing internationally at science fairs, I realized that I want to start a company. So I came back to Ireland when I was around 16. I joined the youth accelerator program called Patch, funded by the Collison brothers and OpenAI. And during that 6-week period with, I think, basically all of Ireland's, you know, top academic performers who are under 21 and things like that, I started a company. And that first company was called Cartshare. It was for e-commerce brands. It was to turn group chats into customer acquisition channels when you couldn't reach the free shipping threshold on your favorite brands. Really cool idea. I marketed that product very well. We launched on quite a few brands. But ultimately, we found it was very, very hard to change consumers' behavior on a product like that. Mm-hmm. So earlier this year, I kind of went back to the basics. I was like, okay, well, I want to start something new. I had already been exposed to these AI technologies that I've been working on during my science fair years. And I just looked at, like, okay, well, these AI models are getting really good. Reasoning models are now a thing. And these models are going to continue to get better and better and better. And yes, the LLM architecture may not stay around forever, but at least other things will be added on top of that to at least continue this cycle or curve that we're on. Mm-hmm. So I had a background in e-commerce and retail. I basically tried to pitch my product to as many retailers or brands I possibly could have. And I decided to ask them about some of their other problems. And turns out there was actually some fundamental issues or problems that retailers and brands experienced that wasn't to do with their glossy website or the beautiful designed Shopify store they had, but it was to do with their back office operations. And I talked to one brand here in Ireland, and they said they had 1,000 suppliers across their retail, 1,000 SKUs in their store. They're selling on Shopify, they're selling wholesale, and they're also selling in their physical retail locations. And they used a system from about 20 years ago to manage that didn't even have an API attached to it. And then they were trying to basically kind of combine that with Excel spreadsheets and humans to fill the gap, which was all the work that the ERP system that they were promised and they pay a lot of money for to do work for them wasn't actually working how they expected it to. So they couldn't get the answers they wanted out of their data, and then they turned to Excel spreadsheets. And that was pretty shocking. Like, you know, a brand that's doing 300 million revenues a year basically running their entire business off of Excel spreadsheets. I just thought that was pretty crazy.
Right.
Yeah. So that's kind of how it evolved into what I'm doing now, which is an AI operations tool that layers on top of existing systems retailers and brands rely on to allow them to get the answers they need really quickly and also perform actions on top of their systems. So yeah, it's like, that's kind of what we're working on right now. Go into more about that later.
I think it's a fascinating story because I think you could talk to a lot of people in the US who are like, we need to get in front of more brands. How do we talk to brands? How do we get an audience with them? As an 18-year-old coming to the United States, you had never been to the US, how do you get an audience with brands?
So I'm still trying to figure that out, to be honest with you. I think I think like most startups, it's difficult in some ways, and it's also quite easy in other ways, right? I feel like one thing I've realized over the last probably 2 or 3 years is that if you build a really, really good product, like a really good one, people tend to talk to each other about it, and retail kind of has this nature of, you know, this kind of homeliness or I don't know, there seems to be a pretty good community.
Yeah.
And I found, like, even looking at some of the really cool Shopify apps maybe that I've looked at in the past, I think the really good ones that do really well build a really great product and then are able to be everywhere and anywhere, and everyone kind of knows the person or the founder who's doing that thing. And so for me, I mean, the way that we got our first 5 or 6 customers was with our first customer before we had even deployed a product onto their system, telling as many retail friends about what we were doing. And I found that to be a really interesting characteristic, that if you build something valuable or at least show something valuable to a customer, they will talk to other people about it. So I'm going to continue going down that road. And I think we have some of the strategies of how we're going to kind of get brands' attention in the US. But yeah, we're trying to bring like some freshness and newness, because, you know, our comparisons are like a competitor who might have a website who doesn't even have a demo video on it. And I'm like, why? So we're trying to do things like that to differentiate ourselves as well.
Yeah. Yeah, seems like a simple thing, but helps people learn about who you are.
It does. I agree with you.
How you mentioned you started with an accelerator and the Collisons were involved. Mm-hmm. Are you looking for additional investment, or are you looking to kind of bootstrap it from here? Talk to me about the investor side.
Sure.
What's been the feedback on that lens?
Yeah, I mean, so we... 5 months ago now, we raised $1.4 million for a pre-seed round from an Australian, really good Australian fund called SquarePeg. And the remainder was filled out by angel investors in San Francisco and New York. So that's kind of how our investment journey has gone so far. So at the moment, we're not looking for any more money. We're just trying to deploy that capital the best way possible, which is mainly engineers and engineering talents. I feel like in this new world, it's like you literally can't hire enough engineers to get where you want to go. I think dealing with this new technology is really interesting. And there's only a certain amount of people who exist who are on the cutting edge of this tech, and trying to get those people comes at a price. So that's kind of mainly why we raise the money. So yeah, at the moment, it's just about getting our revenue numbers up, get deploying into the market, getting into the US market. And that's where we're spending our time now.
Got it. I think there are a lot of founders out there that maybe started with the business side. They're not technical. Clearly, there's a lot of tools right now to help you prototype something. Mm-hmm. How long that lasts is a different question. So you're trying to attract the best technologists in the world. They're not all mercenaries, you know, right? Like, they're not just sort of always going to go for the highest number out there. Mm-hmm. What are some of the ways that you use to attract engineering talent?
So one of the ways is that we actually run our talent and engineering out of Paris. So my co-founder, Jan, he's actually French and he's an AI engineer here. He's 25, so quite a bit older than me. And the way we've kind of attracted talent here is, well, first we've made a decision whether we're going to get talent in the US or versus Europe. And the answer to that was that we would have had to raise maybe 10 times the amount of money to get the same talent we would have had to get in Europe, let alone Paris. And it turns out that a lot of people who are based in France, is actually a lot of AI engineering talent here, like Mistral is a good example of an LLM provider who has a lot of French talent. The founder of Anthropic is also French. And there's a lot of talent here, but the talent tends to actually stay. And they tend to work at like big conglomerates or startups that are really European or French. And I actually kind of understand why a lot of people don't want to go to America. But turns out there's a lot of untapped market here. So the way that we're trying to attract people is that we run hackathons here in Paris, like all the time. So we run hackathons pretty frequently. And, you know, we're kind of looking for that 19 or 20 year old who's just like, he doesn't care about anything else in the world except like just working on a video. And every now and then you find them. And I've been surrounded by those people for a long time. So that's kind of how I do my scoping. And, you know, Johan, my co-founder, is just constantly scoping out the market here. So that's kind of how we viewed it. Sales talent is a different story in the US. I'm hiring people in the US for that. But yeah.
Got it. And then, I guess I'll go on the other side. You mentioned sales talent, which is usually very hard to evaluate because you're generally talking about good talkers, right? You know, so it's, you know, they're very easy to interview and they can promise a lot of things. As you mentioned, like, especially in the US, people tend to be very confident, at least about themselves. How do you evaluate good sales talent?
So for myself, I think valuing sales talent is quite difficult. For me, it's like
I think for everyone, not just yourself.
I think one thing I have realized is actually trying to get sales talent for a new startup in this industry, I thought would actually be harder than it would be. I mean, having at least a conversation with that one or two people who are just going to hopefully transport the pace of the business. I think in the fact for me, it's like I'm so unbelievably young that it's kind of like, it's like if you were like 20 or 22 starting a startup, it would kind of be like, you're a bit young for this kind of thing. But when you're like 18, it's just so obscure and so ridiculous.
Yeah.
People gotta go like, wait.
You'll get a conversation. Like, there must be something interesting here.
Yeah, exactly. So it's actually a really interesting age to go out into the market, especially in an industry that is relatively traditional. I mean, like, who are the players here? It's like, who are the people that we care about in this industry? It's ERP system that no one's heard about. It's like SPS Commerce. It's like NetSuite. It's like SAP. It's like, you know, JD Edwards. Like, all the people within those businesses are very, well, a lot older than me. For me, it's like, it's like trying to see who are the people within those companies or the startups who are trying to compete with those companies or even who they serve that I can kind of like pick out and go, I think they should be on what I'm doing. And so I think I'm still trying to figure out how to scope. I've talked to a lot of people who are in sales before and I agree with you, Rick. It's pretty, pretty goddamn hard. Like, it's not easy.
Yeah, exactly. And then sometimes it takes 6-12 months to figure out, like, is there traction here? Is it, you know, are they doing the right things? It's kind of a funny point. You mentioned like a lot of these platforms were built before you were born.
Yeah.
How does that make you feel?
It makes me feel excited, right? Because I feel like they shouldn't be around forever, if that makes sense. Like, that's the most exciting thing about what I'm doing is that I think there's a really interesting point in the market right now or time in history where it's like, I'll give you an example, like NetSuite Suite World conference happened a few weeks ago.
Yeah.
And they told everybody that their AI software was going to come out a year from now. It's going to get released globally to NetSuite.
Great.
AI agent software is going to get released in a year. And I'm just like, it's just so shocking to me because it's like, why does that have to be the case? It's good that they're trying to adapt and change things. I agree with that. But it's like, that just confuses me because it's like I'm on boots on the ground here working with this technology. This technology is moving way fast. By the time a year from now, is it really going to be at the same point? So I don't know. I think that it's kind of like there's a lot of players in this market. I have huge respect for them. And I kind of want to see how I can bring something new and fresh into this market and into retailers and into brands that I think they, not to their own fault, but may have overlooked as they've, you know, generated just copious amounts of money over the last 20 years. So I think that's my view on it.
Yeah, I mean, it's a lot of these companies are just so slow to do anything. Yeah. And so I think that creates a big advantage for, you know, newer companies. So I think that's, you know, it's very interesting. As you think about being a founder, I mean, everything's on you. Like, you have a co-founder, so that's a huge step, right?
Yeah.
And you're hiring a team, but there's so many things you could be doing at any one time. How do you prioritize, like, decide where to spend your time?
So I think I didn't know how to do this for a long time until kind of recently. It was like, I think it was like a podcast I saw. It was either like something to do with Steve Jobs or something like that. But it was basically like what they did at Apple when it was like real game, when it was really game time for the iPhone and when it was really game time for the MacBook Air, is that they picked like the top three things that mattered in that day and then kind of worked off of that, right? You just pick three things, doesn't just everything else is kind of irrelevant, but we're going to do these three things today. And maybe one of those things is that, okay, we're going to deploy a new architecture onto Source and we're going to kind of reevaluate how we do our prompting. Maybe that's one of the things. Okay, maybe we're going to try land a meeting or talk to 20 customers today. I don't know. I feel like breaking it down to like three things that like everyone company-wide, which is about like six or seven people at the moment, can handle, I think is really powerful and really useful. So I try to break it down and abstract it to the lowest point. It's working pretty well at the moment, but yeah, I can definitely understand and relate to people who are just like kind of frolicking all over the place, because it's there is a lot of things to do. There's like sales, there's like marketing, there's like a customer has this problem and you need to fix it right now, and then there's like this, and then there's like family stuff, and then you have to move places, and it's really busy, it's really tough. So yeah, that's how I try to handle it. Definitely, yeah, work in progress, but yeah,
I mean, it's, you know, that focus seems like a big challenge. And like, there's also like being a manager, meaning like employees need to know what to do. Those goals, how have you found being a manager? Is this something you enjoy? Is this something, because there are a lot of founders who are like, I hate being a manager. I just want to build a company. Like, I don't want to talk to people. So
The longer I do this, the more I realize that you really have to get the fundamental business parts of the business sorted, right? Like, you can't just like, you know, like it's really, I mean, I was trying to decide whether I was going to spend most of my time in New York or San Francisco. One of the things that I wanted to do and decided was that, you know, if I go to San Francisco, I'll be surrounded by people who are my age who are building companies, but I'm not going to be surrounded by people who have like built and have to manage and run companies, which I think is a huge difference, because there's a lot of either true altruism or fake altruism that exists in San Francisco of like, okay, we're going to build a company and change the world. But then when it like, you know, when it comes down to it on a weekly basis and you have to like file tax returns and you have to like pay employees pay slips and you have to do this and you have to do that, and you have to understand like, okay, are we reaching product market fit or is it fake product market fit, or like how much we're going to charge a customer, what's the cost of onboarding a customer? All of those things are really important. And I've realized over like probably the last few months that they're the things that really, really matter. And kind of, if you're not careful, you can definitely get surrounded by a lot of people who are kind of just all looking at each other and going, oh, we're starting a company. And that's a very exciting thing. Like, I mean, when we raised the money, it was great. And there's a lot of that. But now it's just become way more real. And it's kind of been, adding to adapt to that is actually quite, I don't know, it's quite mature. I don't know, maybe it feels more mature. I don't know. It feels cool to be like, okay, now I have to do the business stuff, which I actually really like. It's difficult, but I like it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a transition a lot of founders need to make, and kind of like going from zero to one, which is like there is literally nothing here, and now there's something. I have non-zero customers. I have some money in a bank. I have some employees. There's a real business here. But then like going from one to 10, what do you think, like as you think about the next, you know, no one thinks in 5-year increments, it'd be like a third of your life more or less. So how do you think about the next couple, you know, 6-12 months for the company? What are some of your goals and what are things you're trying to avoid?
Yeah, I mean, some of our goals is like we want to break into the US market. I think like that's been the focus since day one. It's like, hey, can we build a company that's at least applicable to the US market? I just think, you know, if you're going to build a company, you may as well like go big or go home. And the US is a pretty good place for that. I think Europe could definitely be part of our plan over time. I think like we have a lot of European customers. They really like our software. And I feel kind of bad at a little bit because I'm like going over to the US and going, not bye guys, but I'm like, you know, I'm going to the US to transfer the technology over there. But I think that's kind of one thing we've taken into consideration from the very beginning of the company. So working on that and really trying to figure out like, okay, how are we going to distribute our product into the US market? What kind of channels could we use for that? And like, you know, goals surrounding that is like, we obviously want to figure out like, you know, where do we sit, right? Are we going to eventually become something that we own ourselves and we kind of take up a lot of, we basically become the interface for operations teams, the buyer, the head of merchandising, you know, the buyer, the data analyst. They just interact with Source, or are we like a hybrid between how they interact with their existing systems and interact with us? So I think it's kind of more like really big company-wide decisions on where we're going to take our product. But I feel pretty confident in terms of like, I feel pretty confident in the way that we're going to figure out distribution in the US. I think there's some really, you know, going via the POS systems or something like that, I think could be a really interesting channel channel to market, because they kind of have a little bit of the inventory in stock, but they don't have it all. And they kind of have this weird gap between ERPs and themselves. So that's a couple of things, maybe not a direct answer to your question, but that's kind of it. That's kind of how we think about that. Things we want to avoid is we want to avoid running out of money. That's probably that's like an important thing.
They said that's like that the CEO has one job, you know, right? Like make sure there's money in the bank and make sure that company has a vision.
Yeah. So I think I'm doing an okay job.
It's pretty crazy.
Those two metrics. Making sure we don't run out of money. We keep at the pace we want to. Keeping the pace is super important, because as you try to build a product and find product market fit, it can be really easy for you to go, oh my God, we've reached product market fit. Like, let's just go all in. Let's raise another round. Let's deploy everything we've got. And for me, it's like, I want to try to be a little bit more conservative in the way I view where our product fits. Like, we're trying to decide, are we going to service the enterprises? Like, are we going to do that? That will completely change how I think of my next fundraising round or just the pathway of the business. Mm-hmm. So those kind of key decisions are things I want to take my time on, but keep the pace up, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think it makes sense. You, where you're out at the company, you know, I can just hear it in your voice. You're talking a lot about product market fit. Mm-hmm. It's top of mind. A lot of people have a different definition. Most people, frankly, don't have a definition of what it is. And not only what it is, I think people have a general idea of what it is, like a product that matches the market. Okay. How do you know you're there?
So I think you could look at it one way, right? You could look at it and it's like, okay, we have a product and people are willing to pay for it. That's like a really good thing. And we have those customers.
Right.
Great. And I think the second option is like, okay, we have a product, people are willing to pay for it, and we can deploy this at least over time in a manner that like makes sense financially to the business, which I think is another step. And I'd be kind of going towards option two, right? It's like, how do you, like, we have a product, people are willing to pay for it. Right now, have we figured out this is the most amount of money a customer is willing to pay for it, or can this be increased over time? I think it's a really big question. Another thing, if you decided right now, like if we were to go, okay, well, we've reached product market fit, this is the best product ever, and people are willing to pay for it. One thing you could probably, you know, put yourself into a corner in is that, well, what's the churn rate of those customers over time? Like if we've deployed a 30-day pilot, they started to pay for it, and then we decided we've reached product market fit, how do we know that after another 20 days they're going to decide, oh well, it's not worth the amount of money I'm going to pay for this? So it's like, it's those kind of questions which I really need to, well, I am thinking about way more versus the question of like, okay, people wouldn't pay for it, go big or go home. I think that's where like a lot of capital can get deployed really aggressively and potentially end up in a situation where it's not a very pleasant one, where, you know, you're a year down the road, you've just spent money like crazy, and turns out that, you know, 20% of your customers churn or something like that. So yeah, I think that's kind of how I think about it. Now I still want to keep the speed up, and you have to kind of have to decide like, all right, speed versus how comfortable we are with the product. You can't be sitting on it forever, but yeah.
Yeah, I mean, speed is, look, you're a startup, your only advantage is speed. So I definitely think that that's a great focus for you. Mm-hmm. And then ultimately the market, you know, your first 10 customers are so important to your future, because everything that they talk, those are the people you're going to be talking to. If your product can't be great for those first 10 people, then they're going to tell other people. Kind of, it's almost like the reverse effect for you. Have you had experiences trying to identify like who's the right kind of customer and who's the wrong kind of customer? What have you learned about just trying to suss out like, is this a good customer for us right now?
So yeah, we've run into this a lot, right? Like there's a lot of things that get thrown at you if you have a product that is somewhat really relevant to a lot of people. One of those problems is that you have enterprises come approach you and say, hey, we should deploy this company wide. I won't mention any names, but that we basically had to tell them that that is impossible, that it's not going to happen, and we cannot do that. And I think that was really difficult because I had to go on the call, get in front of like C-suite level executives and basically tell them, lads, we're not going to do this. It's just not going to happen. And then they try to convince you to become a consulting company for them. And I said, we're not going to be a consultancy either. Like I basically told them like, you know, we would have to give you all of our resources, every single ounce of our resources to serve you as a customer. And is that fair to another 10 people? And they got that. A way I kind of got around that situation is that we decided, okay, well, if we can just pick like a very little scope within this company and try and match it as close as we can to our existing product, maybe it would be worth trying to, you know, get them as a customer and build a relationship with them. So that's kind of how we've dealt with enterprise queries at the moment. A lot of the time, it's just our product isn't there yet for them. It's for mid-sized companies. So yeah, picking like who's relevant and why and how is really, really difficult, especially when you have a lot of people approaching you with different kind of issues, right? So we had an option there a few months ago that we had like pharmacies in Ireland that were, you know, local. I think there's like 2,000 local pharmacies, like individual pharmacies across the island of Ireland. So super fragmented. And we had an opportunity to service like a bunch of them, but then we realized the capacity to pay wouldn't really be there, although we would build a tool that's good. And we had to like scrap that product. So we decided, nope, we're not doing that, which was really sad because I had a lot of quite sad people going, this would have actually changed my business. So yeah, those decisions are hard, but now we've kind of decided we're going to target the mid-market. So like brands, brands within the $20 million to $200 million range, you know, in athleisure wear, beauty, those kind of things. Doesn't really matter on the SKU size. But that's kind of how we've been targeting those businesses.
Yeah.
You know, they have like 7 people, 8 people on their operations team. And, you know, things are just like, they're just in the trenches at the moment. And they desperately need help. And that's kind of where we come in, at least in the mid-market for now.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a fascinating, it sounds like a great segment for you. What have you learned about other types of businesses that and how they go to market? Do you take lessons from other companies? Like, I'm just going to use an example. Shopify is one that everyone known that started with entrepreneurs and now they're talking with quite big companies. And that didn't seem to hurt them over time. Mm-hmm. Stripe started with, you know, they're really just marketing to developers.
Yeah, they do.
You know, like, how can we have the best APIs and regardless of the size of the company, if we have the best developer experience, people are going to want to use us versus like some of the other companies like a NetSuite where they start at the top and that's their focus. Like, how do you think, like, is there a company you admire and they're kind of not necessarily looking to follow, but take tips and examples from?
Yeah, I think that's a brilliant point. I think like there's two kind of like if you went to the argument, okay, let's start with like the lowest hanging fruit, which is like your local corner shop, right? That's one option for us. Or theoretically, you could go, okay, well, this local corner shop is going to tell their friends and that's going to grow naturally over time and develop into something really, really awesome. Or the counter argument to that is that you go to an enterprise and you say, okay, well, the mid-market are only going to look up at the enterprise and what they're doing. So we must service them first and then we will try to win that portion of the market. For us, it's really, that has been tricky. We've kind of decided that there's a lot of companies out of COVID who is there a company I admire for this? I do actually admire Stripe in the way that they navigated this. They serviced like they did like ground level servicing all of their customers for like the first like hundreds and hundreds of customers they just dealt with directly. And I think that culture is very much here in our business. Like we have most of our customers on a WhatsApp channel, which I think is quite interesting because these are big, big companies and they're just on WhatsApp with us. And that's how we do things here. So I think Stripe is one. But I think for us, it's like we've realized one thing at least, which kind of leads us in a direction here, which is there's a lot of companies out of COVID who expected their company's brand or retail store to grow much faster than it should have because they all went online, all went on e-commerce. And you tend to do, what I've seen at least is that there's been quite a few businesses that have made really large purchase decisions on an ERP system, whether it be NetSuite, whether it be SAP, whether it be something newer. And now they're kind of looking at each other and going, wow, I'm paying $200,000, $300,000, $400,000 a year, and I have to pay consultancies to maintain this. What are we doing? It's not doing what we want. And, you know, we have to buy this thing and this thing and this thing and this thing. And we found that's been a very interesting intersection for us, because we've gone to these guys and gone, okay, well, look, maybe there can be something that layers on top of these systems and does a way gets you more of this direct value you're looking for, and at a really, you know, reasonable price in that sense. Yeah. So yeah, that's kind of how we thought about it. Lots to go on there, but
yeah, no, it's really cool. I mean, I think this layer on top, I would love, we've talked a lot about your journey and just startups in general and starting a business, but haven't talked too much about the business. Would love to learn like a little bit about the company. What does it do? Like, who is it for within the company? How does it work? What's in the product now, and what are you looking to add in the future?
So 100%.
Even just the name, I think I caught the name, but we never even got to that point.
Yeah, no, 100%. I can talk to you about that. So yeah, Source is an AI operations layer, or tool for brands and retailers. What we do is that we help the operations team, which might include a data analyst, someone in finance, buyers, merchandisers, and an operations manager, do a lot of the day-to-day tasks they need to do, but through an AI tool, right? So think of it like ChatGPT for the back office operations of your business. Source sits on top of existing data sources like NetSuite, SAP, JD Edwards, you know, whether Microsoft Dynamics, and also allows you to upload context from existing ways that you do work, which might be through Excel. So Source takes both of these pieces of information, combines them, and allows you to have a ChatGPT-like interface for getting answers around your business. So whether it be creating a forecast and getting you like 80% of the way there and spitting it back into an Excel spreadsheet, or trying to understand what your top best-selling SKUs are using the 20-80 rule, getting answers to these questions is really, really difficult. And it's unnecessarily difficult. So we noticed that a lot of our customers, whether it be a buyer, a merchandiser, or an operations manager, trying to go into your ERP and pull that data to get an answer via a report would take hours and hours and hours of work. Instead, Source pulls this data autonomously, retrieves it, and gets it back to you and spits it back out to you in whatever format you'd like, but also really quickly. So it's like really just being able to allow a business to interact with their existing systems and data in a much more convenient and a natural language way. So that's kind of how we've been pitching it to customers, isn't it? And it's called Source.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, you're working with a lot of legacy platforms, and you yourself kind of said some of them don't have APIs. How do you interact with them?
Sure. So we use some creative ways to interact with lots of people.
I love the word creative. That's just my favorite word.
Yeah, I'm saying creative. Look, we have all sorts of customers, like a pharmacy. One of our pharmacy customers, they were pulling a daily export of all of their existing. So they didn't even have a ERP system. They had a POS system. And they're essentially pulling Excel files representing all of their reports on a daily basis, which was just an absolute disaster. So they had all of their inventory sales for the last 5 years of the business, and all of their inventory stock and all of their sales data for the last 5 years of their business within a POS system. So what we did is we just said to them, hey, look, guys, pull that data once, upload it to Source, and then go from there. And that's how we've dealt with that customer. So that's an example of a creative way how we deal with things. The cool thing about Source, and one of the really big selling points for us, is that we realize that with some of these new AI technologies on the market, we can have a really great competitive advantage against consultancies. Because when we started this company and started to serve customers, they told us that we should use a consultancy to integrate our own piece of software, which we had built, into one of our customers. And when we asked them the price and the timeline, it was something like $50,000 and 2 months worth of work. And we decided that, you know, is this really true? Like, is this actually the case? And I think there's a real big change happening, at least in the integrations and migration space, where we're like, most of our development and engineering time is figuring out new integrations. But not only that, but figuring out how to do integrations faster, better, and even autonomously is our goal. So that's kind of how we're looking at that. And that's kind of how we kind of decided, like, look, we could either pick that, you know, all NetSuite customers are going to be who Source deals with, or we could go in the opposite direction and go, okay, well, every retail business is different to one another, and we shouldn't really change that. So we should just get really, really good at trying to understand the context of their data and the existing systems they have. So that's the approach we take. But again, it's difficult, but we're building tech to handle that. And I think the intellectual property we'll build off the back of that is going to be really exciting.
Yeah. No, it's interesting. I mean, I think the AI, the models and AI keeps getting better. Do you think that AI is smart now? And what do you think we'll be seeing in the next couple of years that we're not seeing today? And are you seeing like skeptics out there still? Or like what's the state of like the executive mindset toward AI?
Yeah, I think there's skeptics, right? I mean, so one thing we've noticed, I think the biggest thing for us is that we've run into less skeptics versus people being afraid. So we've run into more people being afraid versus people being skeptical of what it can
do. So interesting.
Which it hurts the sales cycle a little bit, to be honest with you, because, you know, you can get introduced to a buyer who works at a business and they basically feel like there's either two ways it goes. They feel afraid that source will take their job. And I mean, Maybe that's not a crazy thing to say, or maybe they feel like they'll have a first mover's advantage and they'll try to bring it to the C-suite as fast as possible. And they're the two routes we see most of our sales approaches go. So I think that's a really interesting one. The other thing I see as well is that these AI models, just from being on the ground level, at least, is that these AI models are absolutely ridiculous, and they're going to continue to get ridiculous. I think we had a model come out maybe 2 weeks ago that we deployed across all of our customers within 10 hours, and it generally made our product better by like a factor of like at least, you know, a couple of percentage points. Just like the product just inherently, without any changes, just got better because we released a new AI model into our product, which is really interesting. It's a little scary because it's like, okay, where are we going to have a moat? And I think that will be with our integrations. But that's like an interesting dynamic I'm seeing as well. So yeah, I don't know. I feel like with what we're building here, it will definitely allow brands to move faster and be more competitive in the mid-market. And I think, you know, at least for now, it's probably the risk of jobs being lost is probably not true, but over a long enough space of time, it may or may not happen. So I think a lot of AI startups are looking into people being skeptical about if they should deploy AI to their business.
No, I mean, it's fascinating. Do you think there are too many AI startups, or you just think like everyone is just building because no one knows what the future looks like, so let's just build the future?
Yeah, I think no, there isn't enough AI startups. I think there should be more, because in every vertical ever, like in every vertical that exists within the economy, there's an AI startup trying that may have got you know, between $1 million in funding and like $100 million in funding trying to build something in that space. There's a startup I saw a few days ago raised like $20 million and they were in trucking companies, right? There's a startup I know here in Ireland that has an AI receptionist for dentists. And like they own the Irish market now. They're about to own the UK market. So it's not only happening per vertical, but it's happening geographically as well. Mm-hmm. I think, to be honest with you, I think this technology is just so fundamentally a game changer. We've seen it being a game changer for our customers in the retail space, that there's just a lot of things that are going to start to happen. And, you know, maybe one could argue that that is like a really smooth transition, and one could argue it's a pretty messy one, and probably be on the more messy side. So yeah, honestly, I think there should be more AI startups. What really gets me excited is that company starts in a traditional vertical, it starts winning the traditional vertical, everyone in that vertical goes, oh my God, this is the best tech ever. You see that company 6 months later own that market, and then they raise a really large round. That's like really exciting, because that's like a very clear indicator of like, okay, startup provided value in the market, people are willing to pay for it, and now it's just boom, boom. So I hope that happens with Salesforce, and I think it will. That's kind of how I view it.
No, I mean, it's exciting. And I think there's still a long runway in this market. And there's probably a lot of founders in the audience that are thinking about, like, should I join the next startup? Should I start something on my own? What's your advice to potential new founders?
I think that's a good question. I think it depends. I feel like there's obviously a lot of capital available. Having said what I just said there, I think there's a lot of capital available to a lot of people. And like, if you wanted to start a startup, it's probably like, you should probably start one in the next, you know, five, 10 years. I don't know. It's probably a good time to start it. I mean, it's interesting, right? Like if you see a very clear space in the market or vertical that just is kind of ripe for disruption with this new technology, like, and you think you have an advantage in that market or think you should go after it, sure, that's no problem. But, you know, if you read like Peter Thiel's 0 to 1 book, the equivalent happened in like the early 2000s, where you'd have one man build 5 websites, go to 5 VC firms and raise like 500 grand from each of them. So like there's 2 extremes here, right? Like you shouldn't be that kind of person just raising capital for the sake of it on an idea that probably shouldn't exist. But you know, if you wanted to start a company, and now's the time. There's a lot of capital, there's a lot of bullishness, and if you want to get capital at a good price, now's a pretty good time.
Yeah. No, that's exciting. I mean, this has been a great conversation, Liam, and I appreciate you coming on the program. As you think about retail, what do you think, you know, obviously there are a lot of buyers that are scared about AI, that then there are a lot of that are bullish on AI, but still retail is retail. You're trying to sell stuff to consumers. What are coming out of COVID, and as we think about the next couple of years, what do you think are some of the trends that you're picking up on from your customers right now?
Yeah, so I think at the moment, one trend we've kind of seen from customers is like their willingness to try to. There's been like a really interesting adoption of new technologies to try to kind of make up for some of like the slack that they have in their business. Like I feel like the rate in which technology is being adopted is relatively high, which I think is a good thing. I mean, maybe it's just because I'm within this part of the industry, but I feel like there's less of a focus on the Shopify front-facing store and more focus on some of these like older traditional systems that they kind of need to focus on now, since you know COVID took up all of their time and effort into Shopify apps and you know Shopify apps, new add-ons, making their website look cleaner, things like that. There's also a drive which we're seeing from a lot of our customers to try to figure out how they can get products at a better price. And I think there's a lot of cool startups trying in the market right now who kind of help buyers at least with the sourcing part of their business. So I think I've seen that as well, like a very big strive to kind of get those margins down. I think retail is going through a relatively rocky space stage at the moment. Yeah. So driving down the margins is super important. And also that said, with the spending on new technology, the reason they're spending money on new technology is so they can cut down the cost of what they're using right now. So we are seeing quite a few businesses, well, at least in the Irish market, I think, and I think in the US as well, that there's new ERP systems coming to market very aggressively, and the like of Unleashed. And I mean, on the other side, for startups, at least, there's like the likes of Rillet, who's a completely new ERP system. So there's like definitely like for some of the new brands that are coming up in the new retail, people playing in the retail space, they're definitely not going to go back to the old systems. I think the market is kind of changing in that regard. For us at Source, it's trying to get all of those businesses that are unlikely to change those pieces of software and kind of have this mammoth task that they've kind of created for themselves.
Right. They're not changing anytime soon.
No, not changing anytime soon. So there are kind of customers we want to go after, but yeah, there's lots of new players coming to the market, lots of exciting things happening, and lots of startups too. So it's really interesting.
Yeah, awesome. Well, this has been a really great conversation, Liam. I thank you so much for coming on the program, and look forward to seeing kind of your personal growth as well as the growth of Source too.
Thank you very much, Rick. Thank you for having me on. Appreciate it.
Awesome. Thanks so much. That's going to do it for this week's Watson Weekend. If you've made it this far, you're either a retail masochist or you just love the sound of our voices.
I'm going to say it's option 2. Either way, we appreciate you. If you've enjoyed today's show, give us a follow, give us a like wherever you're listening. Leave us a review, preferably with 5 stars. We'll take 4.5 if you're feeling a little bit stingy. Yeah, it's okay.
And don't just lurk on the channel. Share this with a friend, colleague.
That's right. We're kind of like your little sidekick, helping you bring everybody along in your organization. You can find us on LinkedIn, your Spotify, all the places. And all the links are in the show notes, too.
Big thanks to the community, our listeners, as well as the Kaplan Snacks that keep this circus running. Sponsors, you know who you are. And if you're not a sponsor yet,
I mean, what are you actually doing with your marketing budget? Give us a ring. Call us. Send an email. Rick loves when people slide into his DM. It's his favorite place.
Until next time, I'm Rick Watson.
And I'm Jessica Lisewski. Thanks for spending part of your day with us. Now, you can feel like you can go on and do something better with your life. We'll see you next week.
Bye.